come to order. I apologize for getting a little late start, but our other committees were running late today, too, and unfortunately we've got a full schedule here. I would like to ask just a very brief, Eric Nauman, our fiscal analyst, to give a very brief overview of the provisions that affect education and the various funding streams for background for our members.
So, Madam Chair and members, we'll talk very quickly. You asked for a minute, and I'll do my best to keep it down, of the early childhood education programs within this committee's jurisdiction. I'll begin with the early childhood and family education program. This program is financed with a mix of both aid and levies. It serves families, children aged birth to kindergarten. The program served 127,000 children in fiscal 2009. Expectant parents and families and relatives may also participate. The program is administered through school district. It was originally established as a pilot in 1974, and in 84, school districts with community ed program could establish an ECFE program. Currently, there's about $22 million of levy and $27 million of appropriation in the program. Provides a variety of services, which we can get into if there's questions. The school readiness program is another one of our larger line items, prepares children to enter kindergarten kindergarten is administered through school districts, serves children age 3 through kindergarten, and beginning in fiscal 11, districts were encouraged to focus their funding at low-income students. The appropriation is about $10 million each year, and it is a shifted program, so it is affected by the shift. The same was the case with the ECFE. School readiness was established in about 1991. The Kindergarten Readiness Assessment Program provides funding to implement a kindergarten readiness assessment, essentially a study designed to show the readiness and track kindergarten readiness over time. Teachers assess kindergartners within the first 6 weeks of school on a variety of indicators. I think there's about 32 indicators across a variety of measurements. There's $281,000 appropriated in the base for that. Health and developmental screening aid promotes educational readiness and improved health of young children through early detection factors. There's a formula that weighs to rewards school districts with higher levels of reimbursement for earlier screening. So it's $75 for three-year-olds and then scales down up to the kindergarten entrance. Screenings include assessments of developmental assessment, hearing, vision, immunization review, child's weight and height, et cetera. There's about $4.2 million in fiscal 12, 3.5 in 13. This program is also shifted. The Head Start program began and remains primarily a federal program. Minnesota has piggybacked onto that program and bought some additional slots. We spend about $20 million a year, and it's primarily to low-income students, designed to enhance cognitive, social, and emotional development, and serves primarily 3- and 4-year-olds. And finally, Madam Chair, the Educate Parents Partnership. The purpose of this program is to work with healthcare providers and community organizers to provide brand new parents with information at the time of birth. Parents are provided informational materials and contacts across a broad range of subjects prior to the hospital discharge after a baby is born. It's $49,000 a year for that program.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nauman. The main order of business here today is to hear Senator Michelle present Senate File 331 and to take testimony. And I will turn it over to you, and then I will give some instructions for testifiers because we have got a long list and we would like to get everybody to say their piece, particularly if it's new information. So thank you and welcome, Senator Michelle.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. Appreciate you giving so much time to this issue and to this particular bill, Madam Chair. And congratulations also on your bill signing this morning. Nice to get some good things done. Members, I just wanted to give a couple opening remarks and then turn it over to the folks from MELF, that is the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation. On my left here, but Thank you again for your time and for devoting so much time to early childhood. I think the reason that we're here, the reason that all of us are here in an education discussion, Madam Chair, is because of the achievement gap. We need to do better. I think one of the strongest arguments for action on early childhood, and one of the strongest arguments for this bill, is that critical moment in a child's life, 3 years old, 4 years old. We've all seen and heard the research and the testimony about brain development. Kindergarten is too late, Madam Chair. So what this bill does is focuses on 3 and 4 year olds, redirects, coordinates, and focuses state resources on that kind of magical time in a kid's life so that they are ready for kindergarten, so that more of our kids are ready for kindergarten when they hit the kindergarten door. You all are familiar with some of the studies that talk about 50% of our kids are not ready for kindergarten, 50% not ready. And Madam Chair, I will note up front, I appreciate Governor Dayton has made some in his budget. He has talked about early childhood. He's also talked about kindergarten. And again, I would suggest for the conversations in this committee and elsewhere that kindergarten may be too late. We need to get kids ready for kindergarten, and that's what this bill is focused on. We also want to get our money's worth. Madam Chair. We're spending $400 million. Taxpayers are spending $400 million on child care right now, so that's state and federal. $400 million on child care, $400 million on early ed and school readiness, and then private payers are spending another $1.2 billion. So there's a lot of money in the system already. Given our financial crisis, given our budget right now, we're not talking about new money, but we're talking about redirecting it, coordinating it, and getting more bang for our buck. So that's why we're here, Madam Chair. And then I think the other question would be, why MELF? Why the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation? I am proud to sit here with this group, and you will hear more about them. But you know, we've had a lot of discussion here at the state capitol. We've had an active early childhood caucus. We've had bipartisan groups of legislators in the House and the Senate talk about early childhood. We've done a lot of talking, Madam Chair, but I would argue that this group has done the most in early childhood, especially over the last couple years. They've actually put together pilot programs. They have raised money. They have done studies. They have compelling research and data. I think they're one of the strongest and most credible voices for early childhood in our state. And so they have spent a lot of time over the summer and fall, and then, of course, the first 2 months of this session coming up with this proposal. It has it's thick. Members, I will admit, it's thick. It's got a long way to go. It's, depending on how you look at it, it's 2 or 3 or maybe even 4 committees of jurisdiction. So this is the first stop. But this might be the most important stop, Madam Chair, because if we can make early childhood a part of the 2011 session, I think it's going to be because the members of this committee carry it and make it a priority. So let me turn it over now to one of the.
Michelle, yeah. I think we have an A6 delete all amendment. I presume that's an author's amendment that would put the bill in the shape that you would like to have it.
That is, Madam Chair. Thank you for noting that. So I would ask that the A6 be treated as an author's amendment.
Could we have a motion to that effect? Senator Scheid moves that the A6 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Same sign. The motion is prevailed.
And Madam Chair, thank you for putting getting the bill into the form that we have asked about and worked on. I would also note that maybe for another motion at some time, I would ask that Section 13 on page 9, that's the repealer that has to do with school readiness, that be deleted. That would be an author's request as well. You can choose to deal with that later, Madam Chair, or right now if you'd like. But
we can leave that for now. Let's hear the testimony.
Okay.
And
very good. Let me, Madam Chair, then let me introduce the former CEO of Taylor Corporation, Gene Taylor. She is on the board at MELF as a passion for early childhood. I appreciate her coming in, and I know she spent a little time in the legislative hallways here, so if you could take some testimony from Ms. Taylor and then the other guy at the table here with the funny-looking tie.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate I know that all of you are passionate about this subject, but I would ask you very, very kindly to limit your comments to just a few minutes each. Now, maybe exceptions are the two that are at the table now, but forthcoming. If you're in support, indicate it. If you've got some exceptions, you know, raise those, but try to be as concise as possible so we get everybody an opportunity to testify, because we are really on a tight schedule. I have to walk out and chair another meeting at 4:30, so. Ms. Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jean Taylor. I serve as the Vice Chair of MELF, the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, and until a few months ago, I served as CEO of Taylor Corporation, which is one of the nation's largest privately held corporations with over 9,500 employees and based in North Mankato. People sometimes ask me why business executives like me care about early learning. Let me give you three reasons. First is the moral answer. Like every person in this room, I and other business people care deeply about children, about all children, and about the children in Minnesota. It's just wrong that only 50% of the young children in this state are prepared for kindergarten when they get there. It's wrong, and as citizens of this state, whether we're business people or not, we should be appalled that we allow that to happen in Minnesota. Second is the obvious business reason. Businesses are competitive when they have the best employees. And as the global economy develops, the people in business are becoming even more important. It's critical that we have a well-educated workforce in Minnesota in order for Minnesota companies to compete and stay strong. So focusing on kids as they're getting ready for kindergarten is in the business's long-run interest to ensure that in the coming years our workforce stays strong. Third is a more near-term reason. Today we need to retain great employees in Minnesota, and we need to attract great employees to the state of Minnesota. Communities with great education are strong communities. They're places where people want to live and where people want to raise their families. And a competitive business is one that's in a strong community, in a strong state, and the educational system is a key part of that. So when Minnesota kids aren't being prepared to succeed in school, it's not only a tragedy for that child and for their parents, it's also a big problem for Minnesota employers and for our collective economic future. So, Madam Chair and members, kindergarten readiness is a very big deal for Minnesota. And the system isn't currently getting the job done. We would be foolish to keep pouring money into a system where half of our kids aren't ready. Senator Michelle and MELF are proposing to reform that system. Once we have a system that can achieve better results, we also need to fund that system adequately. But reform has to come first. Let's make it work. MELF Executive Director Dwayne Benson and others will walk through the details of the MELF reforms, but what I want to focus on is the centerpiece of that proposal, which is the parent aware ratings. Our proposal is centered on the parent aware ratings for one simple reason. In the free market, nothing drives quality improvement more surely than informed and empowered consumers who can demand quality by voting with their feet and with their wallets. As a business person whose company's products and services have been rated, I can tell you that we don't always love ratings. In fact, I'm pretty sure that there's not anyone who gets rated that has unconditional love for the system that rates them. But while no rating can be perfect, I can tell you that well-publicized ratings cause companies like Taylor Corporation and others throughout the state of Minnesota to make our products and services as good as they possibly can be so that we can attract consumers who are looking at ratings and expecting quality. That's why Parent Aware is the centerpiece of the recommendations in this bill. Because when those Parent Aware ratings shine the light on school readiness quality, the providers will improve their quality. It happens in business. It has happened in the pilots that MELF has run over the last couple of years. And it will happen statewide if we pass Senator Michelle's bill. Right now, Minnesota parents are largely flying blind when it comes to shopping for childcare, and specifically in the area of school readiness. The market is broken. Now, parents can go into a childcare facility and discern for themselves if the place is clean, if it's safe, if it's affordable. And if they have questions or concerns about those issues, they can look at our state licensing to give them information. So when they're looking for that information about cleanliness, about safety, they can have the information and they can vote with their feet. And so that part of the marketplace is working. But what we're talking about is readiness. We're talking about more than 50% of kids being ready for kindergarten. And that's not the case. There the market is broken. The consumers are not adequately informed. Even well-educated parents can't recognize child care providers that are best at preparing children for kindergarten. This can't be done at a glance. So 5 years ago, when I began my work on MELF, my two daughters were 3 and 5 years old. One was in kindergarten, one was getting ready for kindergarten. And I cannot tell you how much being part of MELF taught me about what it takes and what is important for my girls being ready for kindergarten. Now, fortunately or unfortunately, not all parents can be part of MELF. But all Minnesota parents can and should have access to the information that will help them make good choices about making sure their kids are ready for kindergarten. So when it comes to school readiness, parents need the Parent Aware ratings to inform and empower them so that a well-functioning marketplace can drive quality improvement. So here's how quality improvement works in business. We don't look at the product line and measure every single product that's coming off that line. That approach would be way too expensive, and it would be way too inefficient. So instead, what we do is we ensure that we understand the key levers, the points in the process where the execution is absolutely critical to achieving high quality. And then we relentlessly monitor those points to make sure that we're hitting our best practices. That's how the Parent Aware ratings work, too. The ratings don't test every single child, because that would be prohibitively expensive and that would be inefficient for taxpayers. Instead, the ratings measure the evidence-based best practices that most reliably lead to kindergarten readiness. So, for instance, is learning being regularly tracked and communicated to parents? Are teaching materials and strategies evidence-based? Are families actively involved in the learning activities? Are teachers adequately trained? These are the best practices, according to the best available research, that are most correlated with kindergarten readiness. And in the MELF pilots that we have been running over the last couple of years, children who were in centers that used these practices were ahead of the average kids. So that's how we do quality improvement in the private sector, and that's how we would do it with the Parent Aware ratings as well. It's a proven, it's an efficient, and it's an effective method. In business, we know that no system is perfect, and that's why we have built into our approach continuous process improvement, and we've done the same with Parent Aware. Our starting point has been the best practices that early learning experts around the nation have told us are the best that exist today. The private sector is also committed to staying involved through a private Parent Aware promotion board to ensure that the ratings remain up to date and as evidence-based as they possibly can be. The bottom line about Parent Aware today is this. These ratings are very, very good, and they are much, much better than the status quo. The status quo where Minnesota parents are largely flying blind when it comes to shopping based on school readiness, and taxpayers are spending on programs that are only getting half of our kids ready. Senator Michelle's bill also includes scholarships and tax credits, which the MELF board also strongly supports. This, too, is a business-like approach. Focus the investment on the programs that get you measurable outcomes to meet your goals. Dwayne Benson and others will explain the other parts of the bill, but the Parent Aware ratings is really the centerpiece of our market-based approach, and it's critical to our success in getting many more kids ready for kindergarten. And that's why I focus my remarks on the Parent Aware ratings. Madam Chair and members, I very much appreciate your time and attention. This approach is supported by business, it empowers parents, and it ensures quality. It is a model of reform that takes existing taxpayer dollars and gets better outcomes. And most importantly, it meets the urgent need to make sure Minnesota kids, not just half of Minnesota kids, but all Minnesota kids are prepared for kindergarten, their future, and our future. We have been working at MELF for 5 years on this work, and now is the time to act. I cannot urge you strongly enough to pass Senator Michelle's outstanding bill. Thank you.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before I make my comments, my name is Dwayne Benson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation. There should be three handouts in your packet. One is a quote sheet, a series of quotes about the current system and some about the system that we envision. Also, should be in your packet a letter of support from various organizations. And then finally, a handout that looks like this on the backside that basically charts our current system and then the system that we would envision in the future. So I wanted to bring that attention to you. As Jean Taylor and Senator Michelle said, clearly 50% of our children coming into school are not ready for kindergarten. Now, that may be disputed by some, but at the Early Learning Foundation, we raised and spent $20 million private money, and we spent that to find out the most cost-effective ways to prepare children. And so we've done a fair amount of research, and Dr. Arthur Reynolds makes the case when he makes a case for on the validity of school readiness measures. Here's his quote. Reynolds found out that school readiness results, quote, significantly and consistently predicted third grade MCA reading and math test scores and the need for school remedial services, special education, or grade retention above and beyond the influence of child and family backgrounds. So the 50% number is appropriate, and if you want to get to a return on investment that Jean Taylor talked to, we think our proposal, in fact, we know our proposal best based on our research, gets you there. You've probably heard Art Rolnick talk about a return on investment. For every dollar that's invested, you can get a $16 return. Now, he has demonstrated that over and over, as has Dr. Reynolds, who says you get an $18 return, as does James Hackman, a researcher at the University of Chicago. But two things have to occur if you want that return on investment. Number one, which this proposal is all about, is high quality. You have to get high quality in order to get that return. Number two, it has to be directed to what we call the high return, which oftentimes we call high risk children, and that's how you get the return. This is not universal coverage. This is directed where you get the highest return by providing the highest quality. I should say that the ratings are voluntary, and Jean Taylor spoke about this, the voluntary notion of Parent Aware. It is the centerpiece of this proposal. Good information generally makes markets work. We don't have any information. You can look at that quote sheet, and I think that supports that. Let me say that the ratings are voluntary. No one is required to go through this process. They're voluntary. They could choose to get rated or not. But if you volunteer, there are certain rewards. This is a reward-driven system. It's not a regulatory system. So reward number one for providers is that they get help once they decide that they want to be in the quality rating system. And we provide that with coaching, and we have found in our pilots that it works. Number two, they get more market. They get more customers as a result of having higher quality, the outcome we had hoped for. They also are eligible for publicly funded scholarships, which are provided in this bill. But it's only for rated providers. They will also be eligible, again, if they volunteer, they get rewarded for train and retain tax credits. So they can improve the education of their workers. They can keep them for a longer period of time. But again, they have to be providing quality. The fifth reward they would get would be the HEROES tax credit, which in effect adds money to the system. We found that business cares about this and are willing to contribute. We think with very little prodding, they will provide even more of that. So this money would go to purchase individual scholarships, or it could go to improve quality. Again, this is a system driven by rewards. It's driven by volunteering into the system, and it's not a regulatory system. Now, you're going to hear about people who will tell you how imperfect this proposal is, and I suspect if I had anything to do with it, it probably has a lot of imperfections. But let me say, you can ask a question. You're going to ultimately be asked that question. What's better? The current system, which I think we've been defined by the legislative auditor of 2001 and the McKinsey report that basically said you're spending a lot of money and don't know what you're getting, or what we're proposing. That's the question before you. Compared to the status quo, you should answer these questions, I think. Does Senator Michelle's bill better empower parents? Will they provide powerful rewards for quality? Will this bill do that? Will our reform ensure kids in need are getting what they deserve, a high-quality early childhood education? Will these reforms that Senator Michelle is proposing lead to more accountable public investments? Will they lead to more private investment? Will they give taxpayers more confidence in a proposal that they can support? And will these proposals lead to better kindergarten readiness than the status quo? And the answer to all those questions is yes. So I would urge that you consider this approach. We know that you can close this gap, if you will, the education gap, and we can certainly do a lot better than 50% of our children being ready. So I hope you consider this, and we'd appreciate your support.
Thank you, Senator Benson. I have to call you Senator. It's once you are. Thank you. Can we bring several up at one time so that we can move very quickly between them? I have Lori Davis, Policy Director with Minnesota Early Learning Foundation.
Madam Chair, I'm here to answer questions.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Todd Otis, President of Ready for K, and Karen Kelly Arula from Community Philanthropy Minneapolis Foundation. And Mary Nino, Executive Director of Child Care Works.
Madam Chair, while they are approaching, depending on your time constraints and how you'd like to handle things with the members, it is a pretty thick bill, and you've now adopted the A6. I know Ms. McQuay can walk through or highlight, depending on kind of what level of detail you want, but if and when that's appropriate,
do that.
She can review that for members of the committee.
I think we're getting general statements more than specific to provisions of the bill at this point.
Okay.
Thank you. Let's see, who is next here? Mr. Otis, Representative
Madam Chair.
Otis.
members of the committee. I'm Todd Otis, the president of Ready for K, and I appreciate the chance to reflect on this bill. We support various parts of this legislation and are particularly gratified that the business community has come together to put this together, and salute Senator Michelle for this bill as well. We have a brief history with the Early Learning Foundation. We helped them incorporate. We were part of thinking it up, and we think they've done a lot of good work. So the benefits of doing early childhood right are enormous, as you know, huge for education. Cost us $112 million a year to not have kids ready, so it's very relevant that it be in this committee, Madam Chair. I just want to indicate that we think that in addition to reform, we need much more in terms of resources in this field. Early childhood gets 1% of the state budget. We believe that it would merit a significant increase, but we understand the limits you're under this year in terms of the budget problems. But 1% is just not enough to reach enough kids effectively.
Mr. Otis, is that including the whole package that they're talking about from the child care? Is that amount to
1%? That's state money. 1% of the state budget.
State budget. All right. Thank you.
State of Minnesota. And the Itasca project that has been referenced earlier did a report that indicated it could be up to $1 billion underfunded. Most of it, as you know, is privately funded. But it's a bill that meets many of our goals. We're a group, in addition to Ready for K, which is an early childhood policy and advocacy group, we're part of a group called Minnesota's Future. And one of the key provisions in that set of allies is to create a quality rating system. So we think this is really an important strategic measure. As Gene Taylor said, we think having parents be empowered to see easily and readily what is quality and then make their decisions accordingly is really important, and we've been advocating that for a long time. We think that the access to quality is really important, and access takes many forms. Currently, it includes Head Start, child care, school readiness, and programs that in some cases blend together effectively to deliver school-ready children. Notably in Grand Rapids and Itasca County right now, there's a pilot doing that. But we think the scholarship expansion is good, and we really encourage it, even in this tough time, to find the money. We think it ought to be found outside of the world of education, either early childhood or K-12. We realize it's challenging to do so, but I think either economic development, corrections, or other parts of the budget ought to be looked at before education. And then we think that the tax credits are great. I think it's a way of involving the private sector effectively, engaging support from people who can afford to make contributions to encourage quality, and it's another provision in this bill that are good. So we think, I know we've got to be brief, it's a good bill. We support it. We hope that you'll find funding for it in ways that does not use education funds. And we're happy to be a resource and, again, appreciate the leadership of Senator Michelle on this.
Thank you, Mr. Otis. Karen Kelly is...
Madam Chair, my name is Denise Mayette from the Sheltering Arms Foundation, and I'm stepping in the place of Karen Kelly Arla, who wasn't able to be here today. I have not really prepared remarks because I just found out she was not going to be able to speak, but I do want to say a few words in support of this bill from the School Readiness Funders Coalition. I am speaking on behalf of the Sheltering Arms Foundation, which is a public foundation, and there are a number of public foundations as a part of the School Readiness Funders Coalition, and we are able to step forward and say some words in support of this bill. I do want to say that I think that this coalition of funders represents a portion of the private in the public-private partnership that this is all about, so I think it's appropriate that we say a few words here. We have developed a statement in support of the bill. We support the measured expansion of the parent-aware quality system in Minnesota, which this bill would do. Proposed funding is very consistent with past and current efforts. We also support the policy behind the efforts to establish scholarships and tax credits to increase spending for quality and access. However, our group hasn't thoroughly considered which funding mechanism and sources of funds are preferable for funding early childhood quality. However, we do want to underscore the significant fact that because the earliest years are the time in which most lasting impacts can be achieved, these proposals really have to be considered in addition to, as Todd said, we feel in addition to rather than pulling from existing early childhood programs. I'd also just like to add that our School Readiness Funders Coalition has been involved in an effort to look at the fragmented system of programs that support early childhood, and we truly feel that consolidation of these programs would benefit the proposal that you're hearing today. The bill to do that was put forward by Senator Michelle last year, and we hope that you'll have an opportunity to hear the results of the task force on an Office of Early Childhood. We feel that that would greatly impact the significance of this bill. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And I'm going to try to forgo some questions here so we can get everybody heard, and then we'll have a chance to have the Ms. McQuay review the provisions and then have discussion. Mary Nino, is she here? Melinda, is it Melinda Hagdahl is doing a stand-in? And I think there are two people. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Mary Nino. I'm the Executive Director of Child Care Works. We are a statewide child care advocacy organization whose mission is to achieve and sustain high-quality child care options for families and communities. We are testifying today in support of Senate File 331. Child Care Works has been and remains supportive of a statewide voluntary quality rating and improvement system, and it was one of only three agenda items we identified on our 2011 policy agenda. Our work with parents and providers over the past 30 years, along with extensive research by the MELF, the University of Minnesota, and Wilder Research, has shown again and again how important it is that parents receive information about the quality of child care settings in order to choose the most appropriate placement for their child. We also know that child care providers crave and make use of every opportunity to improve the services that they provide to children and families. Child Care Works, in partnership with the Early Childhood Caucus, has conducted listening sessions with child care providers across the state to listen to their experiences as well as concerns regarding statewide implementation of a quality rating system. What we have ascertained from these sessions and research conducted by the Wilder Foundation about community assets is that a QRAS will successfully increase child care quality and improve parent information. However, buy-in from child care providers at the local level is vital. While parents are certainly key to the use of a QRAS, it is critically important that we focus on making sure child care providers have access to the resources and training that will ensure the quality of their care. I like to think of it as a build it and they will come model, and this model also ensures that parents have real choices among quality settings. While Child Care Works supports Senate File 331, I do want to point out a few areas of concern that we are confident can be worked out with our partners and through the legislative and administrative process. Article 1, Section 1 of the amendment requires that parents residing in parent-aware plus regions with 3- and 4-year-old children be required to use rated programs unless a waiver is granted. We believe that this could severely limit parental choice, especially in rural regions where there may not be enough rated programs for parents to choose from to meet their needs. Article 1, Section 10 of, in the interest of brevity, I'm actually going to let Melinda go into just a little bit more detail about that point. So I have just one other point of concern, and that is Article 1, Section 10 of the amendment requires redirection of federal funding and child care development funds for implementing parent aware. We support redirecting some of these funds to support Parent Aware, but worry that moving funds used for quality improvement services statewide into specific regional areas could be problematic. And we must also always be aware of balancing the amount spent on quality improvements with the amount that directly supports access for families. Child Care Works is committed to the successful implementation of a statewide quality rating system and is available to answer questions or assist the committee as you move forward on this very important legislation. Thank you. Thank
you. And be concise, because I think the rating system is actually probably part of another committee's jurisdiction, but so if you could just be as concise as possible.
I will. Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. My name is Melinda Hugdahl. I'm with the Legal Services Advocacy Project in St. Paul. I want to thank the Early Learning Foundation and Senator Michelle both for all of their work for working on this issue about improving school readiness for kids. It's such an important issue, and we're very glad that it's having the discussion that it is this session. So I want to thank Senator Michelle for that and the chair for having this hearing. Legal aid represents low-income families across Minnesota, including families who receive child care assistance. And our concern is limited to one issue with the bill, which is the provision that requires child care assistance families to only access providers who've opted into the quality rating system. The purpose of child care assistance, as many of you know, is to enable parents to work and move towards self-sufficiency, and child care assistance helps those families afford child care so they can go to work. Our concern is that the bill significantly reduces access to providers by artificially reducing the child care market. For example, the bill as originally introduced required parents to only use rated providers once 25% of the providers in that region opted in. Put another way, that restricted the available child care market by 75%. The amendments remove the 25% threshold. Now that will be put into the hands of the Department of Human Services. Where that threshold should be and whether parents should be mandated to use only rated providers is an important policy discussion that still needs to take place. It's important to note that the Early Learning Foundation report notes that nationally, rating systems top out at about 30% provider participation, which is still a 70% market reduction. A very quick example, Madam Chair, if my family lives in Greater Minnesota and I receive child care assistance for my two kids and I have to use a provider that's part of the rating system, let's assume I live in Region 3, which reaches from Aiken County to Cook County. The nearest rated provider may be in Duluth, even though I live and work in Grand Marais. Because the provider is highly rated, as most are, I also have to compete for those available slots with that provider with the other families who want to use that same high-quality provider who may or may not be receiving assistance. So I'm also competing for the providers that are in the system, but within the slots that they have as well. If there are no slots available, my only other choice is with another rated provider. Currently, provider participation rating in the system is at about 14% statewide, although it was significantly lower in the Greater Minnesota Pilot Region. And the bill does talk about a waiver. The bill has a provision for a family to opt out of the requirement to use a rated provider. However, it must be filed with the state and approved by the Department of Human Services before child care assistance can be paid. Our concern is this will result in delays to the provider being able to accept the family, and thus the parent will wait to go to work. In many cases, the provider will be able to fill those slots with other children, and the parents will have to start over.
Ms. Hagdahl, those decisions are not a jurisdiction of this committee, so I appreciate your raising that issue.
Sure.
But are there any other points that you would have that would relate to the education, or otherwise I appreciate your testimony on that amount?
Not really, Madam Chair. Our issue is just if there's not sufficient access, the families that we're trying to help through the program are just not going to have access to child care at all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think the next three testifiers may have a different perspective, so why don't we at this point stop for a minute and have Shelby McQuaid walk through the bill and give us just a basic overview, and then we will continue.
Madam Chair and members, I'll walk through the bill and try and point out the differences between the introduced version and then the delete everything where those differences exist. Section 1 requires parents to choose a rated provider, rated under the Parent Aware system. Section 2 allows those providers to be paid above the maximum. Section 3 makes definitions. In the bill as introduced, there was a definition of a minimum threshold, and that was removed in the Delete Everything amendment. Section 4 requires the Department of Human Services to make a develop a request for proposal. This, in the introduced bill, was a requirement of the Department of Administration. That was changed here to the Department of Human Services. This requires, then, the commissioner to consult with the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation to develop that request for proposal and makes the eligible responders, including units of state and local governments, nonprofit organizations, research organizations, and educational institutions. The section outlines a timeline by which the commissioner shall make that request for proposal and then requires the commissioner to redesign the RFP every 3 years. Subdivision 2 sets the basic criteria for the quality rating system and defines that the rating system must be, the ratings must be indicated using stars. Subdivision 3 creates a method for conveying the ratings and provides that the list of ratings is the final of the commissioner, is the final decision of the commissioner. Subdivision 4 requires an evaluation if private funding is available. Section 3 is the process for selecting parent aware regions. And Section 5, Madam Chair. Subdivision 1 then divides the regions into the economic development regions of the state, and Subdivision 2 sets forth the application process that parent aware regions are to follow. And Subdivision 3 then of that section requires resource and referral agencies to prepare and submit the application. The bill is introduced with silent on the application, and this the Delete Everything amendment points to resource and referral organizations to be the preparer of that. Subdivision 4 requires that the commissioner develop the application process and allows economic development regions 9, 10, and 11 to be automatically approved and requires the commissioner to approve all regions by June 30th, 2015. Subdivision 5 then requires that the Commissioner of Human Services designate parent aware regions as parent aware plus regions when there is a sufficient number of programs rated for each type of program. And this this language in the bill as introduced referenced the minimum threshold, which was taken out in this bill, and gives that discretion to the commissioner. Section 6 begins at the top of page 5, and this sets the early childhood education scholarship locations as the parent aware plus regions. Subdivision 2 defines the scholarship eligibility as parents with an income less than or equal to 47% of the state median income. Subdivision 3, the eligibility determination in the bill is introduced, required that the Department of Revenue establish eligibility based on the state median income, and that was taken out in the Delete Everything amendment and requires the Commissioner of Human Services to develop an application process. Subdivision 4 sets the scholarship value at $4,000 for each child, and Subdivision 5 defines the use of the scholarship. Subdivision 6 outlines a transition for allowing three, requires that the quality standard be 3 or 4 stars that are for programs that are eligible to receive the scholarships, and allows then in paragraph B the first 2 years to that programs that are rated with a 1 or 2 star to be eligible to receive the scholarships in the first 2 years. Subdivision 7 sets forth the process by which the scholarships are redeemed by the parent and remitted to the program. And Subdivision 8 prohibits the scholarships to be counted as income for the purposes of those programs listed in that subdivision. So Section 7 makes additional requirements of the school readiness program to arrange for early childhood screening and appropriate referral, and requires that children be served a minimum of 12 hours per week. This implementation date was in the original bill was effective immediately, and the delete everything amendment changed it to be effective July 1st, 2013 and later. Section 8 makes some conforming changes to conform to the repeal of the school readiness aid under a later section. Section 9 requires that the Commissioner of Human Services and Education report to the committees having jurisdiction over early childhood education and child care on how to streamline and identify barriers and impediments to applying federal child care assistance and Head Start program funds in the form of a scholarship. Section 10 requires that the Commissioner of Human Services direct a certain amount of money from the federal child care development funds for the purposes of implementing Parent Aware. In the bill as introduced, the amounts were in the bill, and they were also appropriated to the Department of Administration. In the Delete Everything Amendment, it is left for the Commissioner of Human Services to just the amounts are left blank, and the and also an amount of money would go to the Commissioner of Human Services for the RFP to manage the Parent Aware. Section 11 is the waiver process requires the Commissioner of Human Services to develop a waiver process for the requirement of parents to use rated programs. That was in Section 1. And Section 12 is the appropriation to the Human Services for early childhood education scholarships. Section 13 is the repeal of school readiness aid. And then Article 2, the tax credits, I'll just go through real quickly. Section 1 and 2 count the credits as federal income. Section 3 reduces the K-12 education credit. Section 4 establishes the credit for early childhood professionals. Section 5 establishes a credit for contributions that increase the number of scholarships. And then Section 6 establishes a credit for contributions that result in improvements in quality at those programs. And the Delete Everything Amendment makes no changes to the Article 2, so it is as introduced.
So in the Article 2...
Madam Chair, Article 2 begins on page 9.
So, Dr. McQuay, the Article 2 is all the tax kinds of provisions that are a part of this.
Madam Chair, that's correct. There is the reduction in the K-12 tax credit and then... the creation of three additional tax credits.
This might be an appropriate time to just review briefly the challenges of dealing with a bill of this complexity because of the various jurisdictions that it must visit. And we're starting here at education, and we probably maybe have the smallest component of it, although significant. And the Health and Human Services covers a lot of both the potential resources, but also the approval and the other kinds of issues that are around the Parent Aware and that rating system in terms of access, how they might use those funds, and a lot of them federal. And the Tax Committee obviously is going to be visiting with that. And so at some point we will need to deal with that because the provisions that are fiscal and affect education will need to be carried in the education bill. So, this is one that cannot just travel on its own because of the interplay of all of these three jurisdictions. So I just want to explain that we're here to hear most of the things that relate to the provisions that are in the Education Committee. So I'm going to proceed on with the testimony before we take any further questions and possible action here. So I have Steve Kerr from the Anoka-Hennepin School System and Tom Pritchard, Minnesota Family Council. I don't know if you two are compatible enough to sit next to each other, but we'll invite you here. No. And Oki Hennepin was my former employer, so I can get by with that.
Senator Olson,
Mr. Kerr.
I am Steve Kerr from the Oki Hennepin School District. I'm also here speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Community Education Association. As school districts, obviously, we support quality, especially the spirit of the bill, which proposes to enhance both quality and access to early care. Clearly, as school districts, if our students are coming to school prepared and ready to learn, obviously, it makes us more cost-effective and more effective as school districts. So clearly, we can be supportive of that. We have some concerns, and we've expressed those with the author of the bill. He's offered an oral amendment to in regarding the school readiness repealer. That obviously is of great concern for us as a school districts. Of less concern, but still issues that we've talked about is that the bill appears to for school districts is to increase mandates for school districts, and by that I mean the mandate to provide instruction for a minimum of 12 hours. Plus, it adds additional program review process on top of the review process we have with the Minnesota Department of Education and our local school boards. I should talk a little about the school readiness program. We use school readiness both as a program, and we've used it around the table here at the Capitol for a couple of years. When I'm referring to school readiness program, it is would be as it was described by the committee assistant at the beginning of the meeting. School readiness as a program receives about $10 million in state aid annually. With that, local school districts leverage that in to be approximately a $22 million program annually. The state appropriation for the program really hasn't changed since the inception of the program in about 1991. In local school districts, the school readiness program generally is meeting 2 to 3 days a week for 6 to 9 hours of instruction a week. When I surveyed state school readiness providers in school districts, 90% of them are offering a two-day-a-week program, with 80% of them indicating they provide a three-day-a-week program for their community. The program serves about 33,000 students statewide. Just under 20,000 of those are on free and reduced lunches. In addition, probably a relationship with school districts that this program has that is not always very visible when I talk with legislators is that it is the primary placement option for early childhood special ed in terms of a community-based option. So about 8,000 students statewide from early childhood special ed programs are placed in school readiness as their education point of least restrictive environment. This is done because it's cost-effective. It's done because data sharing is easier. It's easier, for example, in a school district like Anoka Hennepin, if we have one child here and one child here and one child here in various child care providers, that means a staff person spends a lot of time driving around to those locations to service those individual students, whereas we can offer concentrations in classrooms and locations that make it very efficient for our early childhood special ed staff to service those students. Regarding the new mandates, I think, for the 12 hours per week, I think what we've suggested is that we have a strong base in school-based programs that we can build off of. We've got licensed staff who are using approved curriculums and are doing standardized assessments with students. And it seems to be a base that we could use to assist in the public policy arena around improving quality for early care and early childhood. And it seems to be a base that we should build on rather than to try to take it apart. The other piece, we've talked a little bit about the additional review process with school districts. I don't know if committee members are aware, but each school readiness program has to file a biennial plan with the Minnesota Department of Education regarding our school readiness programs, talking about what curriculum, what assessments we're going to use. This appears to lay another layer of operation on top of that we will need to comply with. With that, I will conclude my remarks.
Okay. You might want to stay there, but I do have a question right now. You mentioned that you talked about cost effectiveness. Do you have any measure over the years that you've been running this program of what happens in kindergarten with the kindergarten assessment? Have you been able to track the effectiveness of this program in relation to their readiness?
Senator Olson, yes, we do. The State Department of Education at this time doesn't collect that data and aggregate that data, but it does require us as local school districts to do assessments with students. And I can speak for Anoka Hennepin, yes, we do. We've tracked those students, and I know of other school districts. I believe St. Paul has done it, Bloomington has done it, where they've tracked some of their students to see how they're progressing in school.
As we go forward in working with this in terms of our funding and the relationship even with this bill, that would be useful information, even if it doesn't come through the department. So if you're tied in with community,
I'd be happy to share that
with you.
Could
obtain that for the committee, we'd appreciate it. Thank you very much. Mr. Pritchard.
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council. And I'm here to speak in opposition to the bill. And I think, first of all, I want to say I think we all want to help children. That is our goal. And I guess the question is, what is the best approach to doing that? And I'm concerned that the bill and the general approach on preschool education is taking us in the wrong direction for a number of reasons. First of all, if you step back and you look at preschool programs, what they're basically doing, or the government is doing, is incentivizing parents to turn over the raising and caring of their care for their children to other people, third parties. So in a sense, we're saying parents will incentivize you, will subsidize having somebody else care for your children. And I would argue that the best care a child can receive is by their parent. Secondly, the concern I have with preschool, many of these preschool programs, is they aren't effective. The studies I've seen, there's a massive study out on Head Start just a couple years ago by the government. It's really the gold standard of studies. They looked at 5,000 children, and they found that there was a fade-out by the first grade in terms of any benefits they received from Head Start programs. And in fact, excuse me, five-year-olds were worse off in math than students who hadn't gone through Head Start. So I think there's some questions as to their effectiveness. I know there's a lot of comments made at different times about $1 spent on preschool programs is going to improve, is going to save us $7, $10, $15, $18 down the road. But in fact, a lot of those statements are based on studies, like, for instance, the Perry Preschool Program, which was done in the 1960s. And these programs have not been replicated. And so I think the results are really suspect in terms of the actual benefit that these programs result from. And in fact, there's studies showing that preschool programs can actually do harm to children. There's a study in 2005 by out of Stanford and the University of California, Berkeley. They studied 14,000 kindergartners. And they found it actually hinders, these daycare programs hinders a child's social skills and motivation to learn. So by putting children in many of these programs, we're actually doing harm to the children. Let me just turn quickly to the bill. Concerns I have with the bill. First of all, it's not targeted at the children most in need. Basically, any child under whose family is 47% of medium income is eligible. So you're targeting middle-income children as well. As far as the voucher, I support vouchers in the terms of empowering individuals to make decisions and harness the marketplace. That's a good thing. But the concern with this bill is that not only are there vouchers given to parents, but there is an imposition of state standards on these child care, daycare, early child care programs. They're not focused just on health and safety issues, but they're also focused on curriculum education. And the best analogy I can give for my concern about that is the profile of learning, which is a very controversial issue here a number of years ago, where the state attempted to impose state education standards on all public schools. And in fact, I think the analogy makes this program look worse because, in a sense, it's reaching out to pull in to state regulation, in a sense, private child care providers. Now, some would say, well, this is a voluntary program where nobody's going to be forced to do it. But it was interesting, a couple years ago in the House author of the bill made the comment in committee regarding the QRS, the quality rating system, that, in fact, it would pressure private providers to embrace the rating system. Why? Because, one, if they don't, they're not going to receive funding, state funding, and secondly, they're going to be stigmatized as not being rated providers. So there's going to be a lot of pressure for private daycare providers to come in under these regulations. Specific concerns with the bill, Article 1, Section 1, it talks about a parent must choose a rated provider. And I thought it was interesting. if you live in a certain area, you'd have to choose a rated provider. But if you're not, you can choose what's in the best interest of your child. So in a sense, there's almost a conflict there because you're not giving the parents the ability across the board to choose.
Mr. Pritchard, can I ask you to wind up? We have
okay.
got to have, allow each of the others some time. So.
Okay. I'm concerned about the expansion of the bureaucracy, Section 6, Subdivision 3, data privacy concerns about tracking names and addresses distributed between agencies. Section 7, it incorporates early childhood screening, which is extremely controversial. And it's interesting in sections on Article 2, Sections 4 and 5, it talks about success. Success is based on the number of professionals using the services, the government program, and also the money that is brought into the system. So their measuring inputs are the basis for success, not the outputs. Finally, what should be done? I think we should be focusing on K-12 education, expanding parental options there without further state regulation. I think in this bill I would eliminate the QRS and also the bureaucracy and target the most needy. And finally, if we really want to help kids, I think we need to focus on strengthening marriage and families, because studies show that a child is 90% less likely to be raised in poverty if they're headed up by a married parents. And there's a study which shows how you can eliminate the achievement gap. It was a massive study of thousands of students by a professor out in California. And he said you can eliminate the achievement gap if there are two factors: a high level of religious commitment and intact married families in the lives of those children. Now, the state can't do stuff with the religion, but in terms of strengthening marriage, I think that's the way to go. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Ephraim, can you give a concise testimony to appreciate, because we need to have a little discussion here before we can wrap up action here.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman.
Thank you.
And members of the committee, my name is Karen Ephraim. I'm here on behalf of Education Liberty Watch, and we also oppose this bill strongly. First of all, the 50% that keeps getting bandied about not being prepared for kindergarten, we are one of the groups that dispute that. It is based on the kindergarten readiness assessment, which is extremely vague and subjective. And the department themselves said that only 3 to 10% are actually not at all prepared. And so it's a glass half full, half empty as far as the ones that are not fully prepared. There is no evidence that quality rating systems improve childhood outcomes or program quality. And I hope that you found in your packets this PowerPoint and the list of quotes and references that I gave about quality rating systems, because there are detailed quotes about that. And in fact, the MELF third-year evaluation actually says, "The design does not permit us to determine if parent-aware causes outcomes for programs, parents, or children. We can look at patterns of associations, but causation cannot be determined." So then it makes it almost impossible to carry out the language of the bill on lines 331 and 332 that says parent-aware must use quality ratings shown to be linked to improving children's school readiness outcomes. If they don't know, and if their evaluations can't show any difference, any improvement, any linkage, then why are we doing this, and why are we taking it statewide? The report admits that 2/3 of the program in the pilot program are automatically given 4-star ratings. That includes Head Start programs, which, as Mr. Pritchard mentioned, the child outcome study for Head Start that just came out last year showed a fade out by first grade and harm to the math skills of 3-year-olds. It doesn't seem fair that a program of that kind of quality gets an automatic pass and a 4-star rating. And Head Start was also found by the Government Accounting Office to be fraudulent in the way that it does its income statistics, and it doesn't verify these things. So that's a concern. There's a whole new bureaucracy that's set up through the Commissioner of Human Services. There is no discussion of the cost for the Departments of Administration, Education, or Health and Human Services to set up this request for proposal. And if Parent Aware and MELF are already admitting that what they're doing doesn't show the answer the questions that you're trying to ask, how can these departments do that request for proposal? There's data management. They set up a whole big data management system that raises privacy concerns. And there is a taxpayer-funded data transfer to MELF or whoever does this, sanctioned by the bill on lines 4.14 to 4.16. The screening was mentioned. It is required in the bill, but it doesn't acknowledge statute 121A.17 subdivision 3E, allowing conscientious objection to get out of screening, or subdivision 5, which states that districts are required to notify parents that they can opt out of screening altogether, and that's a problem. There are multiple quotes about the evaluation from Virginia in an older study in 1996 showing concerns about these types of programs limiting access and choice, as well as implementation of politically correct standards. And overall, there is not only no evidence that early childhood programs close the achievement gap, but there is actual evidence of both academic and emotional harm, especially for poor children. So there are a lot of problems with this whole concept of the quality rating system, and we strongly urge you not to support it.
Thank you, Dr. Ephraim.
I think
we're going to stop at this point and have some discussion. You want to?
Yeah, Dr. Ephraim mentioned there was the study, the research that these programs are doing harm. If you could provide that, that would be helpful.
Yes.
Thank you,
Madam Chair and Senator Wieger. I will provide a whole sheaf of studies and references for you.
Senator Torres-Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if this is the time. We have about 5 minutes, so I'm going to try to be brief, but I do have a couple of questions.
Let me just stop you. We will be, I think, having an amendment that we're planning to remove the provisions that are related to education. So they will stay here in this committee. And that doesn't mean that that's the end of the dialogue and discussion of this, because it will be a part of our discussion when we are working on our budget bill. So if you can, I don't know if you can keep the focus there or that can take advantage of the resources we have here now, but I know they'll be back when we're working on those issues as well.
Actually, Madam Chair, that's the only question I have. I truly believe that this is the right thing to do, but I do want to know how are we going to fund it. So,
thank you. Are there any other questions? But Senator Nino, do you?
Yep. Madam Chair, I will offer up the A9 amendment.
Senator Bonoff, do you want to comment or wait for the amendment?
Madam Chair, I too had an amendment, so I'll wait till Senator Nino does his.
Excuse me. Madam Chair, as it's being passed out, are we looking at 5 o'clock perhaps? Or
If we go to 5 o'clock, I will turn it over to Senator Nelson, because I have to leave and chair another committee over in the state office building. Poor planning here. So Senator Nino has offered the A9 amendment, and that does delete the areas that are affected or are part of the education budget. So it will leave them here so that the rest of the bill can advance to the Health and Human Services Committee. And then from there, they will be dealing with it to the Tax Committee. We're trying to deal with that complication. So is there discussion either to the amendment or continue raising issues, because this deals with the education provisions.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shea.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, what is this to the language that's going to stay here? Or is this the way the bill will leave us, the pieces will leave us? I don't know.
It will leave the issues that affect the Department of Education, the Head Start, the school readiness, and so the deleting Section 13, that is the one that you were offering to do, that this amendment does that. So it takes it out of that bill going forward, but it will leave it here. Ms. McQuay, would you like to amplify and cover up for my incompleteness of describing the amendment?
Madam Chair, what you said takes is taken out of the bill. It deletes the portions related to Head Start, the Department of Education, school readiness out of the bill, and in doing so, that leaves those sections on the table. For this.
It does also repeal or take out one of the sections in the tax one, and that is the education credit reduction.
So,
Senator Hammond.
Madam Chair, just so I'm clear, so what we're doing is by this amendment, after the bill is amendment, there will be nothing in the bill that has anything to do with this committee. Is that correct?
Pardon me?
That after we adopt this amendment, assuming we do, that what we have in the bill will not at all have any education-related materials. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
It deals with the provisions that would be a part of our education bill. Okay. Most of those are funding-related.
Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle.
If I could, just to perhaps echo what you are saying and help frame this for members, this has a ways to go. I believe that next we'll be going to Senator Hand's committee, where there's a lot of policy and funding issues. There's obviously a tax committee discussion. And then my preference, we'll wait and see as the days and weeks goes on here, but my preference would be that a large part of this bill, or what began at this bill, is in front of your committee again, Madam Chair. And that would be, I think, the appropriate path for it to go.
Madam Chair, question?
Senator Bono.
Madam Chair, the amendment that I had drafted was in regards to how we might pay for the scholarships, but it sounds to me like that you believe the scholarships ought to travel to Health and Human Services and be funded in that budget area. So if that's the case, then would you not see using the education budget as the vehicle for paying for those scholarships?
Why don't you raise the issue of your amendment so that you can...
Okay.
That's the context.
Very good. So, members, I have the A-10 amendment and the... Sure, pass it out, please. Thank you. The A-10 amendment, and this was in regards to when I first read the bill, I was quite concerned about using the school readiness dollars to pay for the scholarships because I didn't think that was appropriate, particularly because we're talking about the pilots. These are just scholarship pilots. And so I proposed, because I didn't want to lose the scholarships, that we consider using compensatory dollars for the scholarships. And my rationale for that was that... that compensatory dollars are really an understanding and a realization of students who are most at risk. It is tougher and more expensive to make sure they get all the services they need to be successful in school. And so if we're going to give scholarships to families of at-risk children, what better way to spend our dollars that are directed towards students in poverty than to direct some of those dollars at 3- and 4-year-olds? In addition, given it was just for the pilots, it wasn't a very big number that would actually decrease what our schools got on a per pupil basis. We're talking about really it was $8 million in 1 year, $10 million another, and then because of the shift impact, it turned out to be a little more than that. But it didn't appear to be something that would greatly affect our school districts while giving us an opportunity to to continue the pilots and see what works. And ultimately, I never thought that that would fund them long term. It would just be. So again, Madam Chair, it doesn't, I think, you know, if you're thinking that we do this out of Health and Human Services, we don't need to do this. But again, just to put it on the table as a possibility.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Bonner. Are there questions, Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, maybe it's more of a comment than a question, and I don't want to delay your leaving, but I'm glad you're still here. Because I think it's really important that we weigh in as to how, just how critical many of us, or I, feel that this issue is, and that we really need to see this through. And it seems important to me that that message go along to the Health and Human Services Committee. I mean, I understand Senator Han is here, but there, I hope that what we're doing, the way we're doing it, doesn't kind of just mean we're leaving it out there for other people who may not have the concern, who may not or don't have the perspective perhaps that we do here about our system of education and the K-12 and the early childhood, all of that and how it works together. And others on this committee more than I have put an awful lot of time and energy into this issue. I have been in and out of it, you know, over the years, but it's something I care deeply about. And I think it's the most important money we spend. And so, and we don't do it in a very well-coordinated way right now. And so I think I would certainly like, when it, maybe the question is, when do you think we'll be dealing with the education? I mean, I don't know what's left, actually.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Well, yes.
My head's swinging. Senator Scheid, we have to have our budget bill done by the 25th of March, so we will be dealing with these issues and these funding streams. I think that's part of the reason I asked for the information from Anoka Hennepin is I think that can be useful to us to determine, because there's some policies. While that was taken out, the repealer part of it, they were setting some policy in terms of the number of hours and so on that was different than what's in practice. And I think we should know how effective that is, because that could still be a linkage at some future point. But I think that we need to be the ones that would be deliberating on those expenditure parts that are part of our jurisdiction. Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have a couple of questions for the author. A couple of things that were in the amendment that were new to me. I want to understand your thinking, Senator Michelle. In terms of the change in the way we're bringing the parents into the program, instead of sending a letter out, which is a very proactive measure, saying you qualify for a scholarship, which I would presume, and I understand that when we did that before, the take-up was like 100%. Now we're suggesting that instead that we have them fill out an application. And so I'm wondering why that change, and don't you think that there will be a significantly less participation with that change?
Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Ms. Davis to address that from
Thank you.
MELF.
Madam Chair, Lori Davis, Policy Director at the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation. Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, the change in that amendment was partly in response to the fact that it was unclear how much funding might be associated with it. So to send letters out proactively to all eligible families, knowing that the funding would be limited, would set up a situation where families would get notified of a benefit that would quickly not be available to them. So that was part of it. And I think that in the way that it worked in the allowance pilot and the way it worked in the St. Paul scholarship pilot was that families worked. Part of what we're trying to do here is create a relationship between high-quality providers and these families who most would benefit from their services, so that the provider would, and in situations in the allowance and the scholarship pilot, the provider did help families fill out those applications. So you're trying to tighten up that relationship between the provider and the family.
Okay. There are no further questions on the amendment. Could we act on the amendment?
Sure. I have a question, Madam Chair. I'm unclear about, are you talking about the A-10 amendment? No, we're talking about the A-9 amendment.
A-9 amendment. The A-10 amendment is Senator Bonoff's amendment, and I think that would be appropriate for her to bring as a part of our discussion when we're dealing with this in our budget discussions.
Thank you.
All in favor of the A-9 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. What is your pleasure? This meet needs to move on to the Health and Human Services Committee.
Madam Chair, if I could just,
Senator Michelle,
kind of a maybe in the form of a concluding remark. I know you're trying to gauge your own committee's opinions there, but let me just commit that I will work with any and everyone, and I think that has been MELF's attitude and tone as well. This committee hearing this afternoon was the first I'd heard from Dr. Ephraim or Mr. Pritchard. I'm not sure that I can get them to a point of agreement because it struck me listening to them that they don't think there's really a role for government in early childhood. We're already there. We're already spending $400 million. $400 million of taxpayer money. We are involved in early childhood. We can choose to spend it better, to reform it, to coordinate it, or not. You can they can oppose this bill, but we're already there, and I think that's really the focus of this bill is existing resources. How do we do it better to get better results, which is readiness for school? So I just wanted to add that point and again say my door is open, and I know the others who are supporting this bill have been clear on that.
Appreciate that very much. Senator Thompson?
Madam Chair, for me, I don't know how the others feel. I would have a difficult time making any kind of a decision on this at this point. And my understanding is that it may end up coming back here once we're more attuned to breaking it up between the different committees. I might suggest a motion, and I want to see what the folks think, that we send this on, recommended on to Health and Human Services with no recommendation whatsoever, with the expectation that we'll learn more about this bill. I certainly don't feel that I have an understanding sufficient to cast a vote on this bill right now myself.
Is that you're offering
and
that
I
motion?
I will make that motion, yes.
Is there any discussion on that motion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
Here's the motion does prevail. So the motion to send it on to the Health and Human Services Committee without any recommendation at this point has prevailed. Thank you very much, all of you, for your presentation. And this
Madam Chair?
Not the end of this. And I'm going to turn over the chair to Senator Nelson so we can take the testimony from the three remaining people for your benefit.
This is strongly that we should do this bill.
No. I don't know where we
I think that she had a recommendation, strong recommendation. So I'm befuddled right now. So I have to
take your testimony now.
Okay. Are you familiar with this?
We should continue next week.
Okay.
My neighbor.
This piece is over.
What else is she doing? She's somebody who's involved.
Oh,
gotcha.
That's
before.
How quickly?
Not sure what's left. What are we going to do now?
I don't know. Apparently, we have some other things on the agenda. Some other people, I think, just not this issue. Well, hey.
Thank you.
Yep.
Are we done?
Okay. We'll come back to order, please. I know we have a few more testifiers that we need to hear from today. We have some folks from community education. If you could come to the testifying table, please.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, we're not going to talk any further than on the educational component of the program.
We are not talking about Senate File 3-1 anymore. Is that your question?
Yes, okay. Just a heads up, I did have amendments. I'll have them later.
Yes, we will address those when we bring up that portion of the bill
okay.
for us. Thank you. All right, do we have Melanie DeLuca?
DeLuca.
Please introduce yourself for the tape.
I will.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Melanie DeLuca. I'm the Director of Community Education for the Orono School District, and I also represent the Minnesota Community Education Association, which has 1,200 members involved in community education across the state, and my colleague.
My name is Dave Maurer. I'm the Community Education Director for the Cambridge-Sandy School District. I'm representing our department and our district and Minnesota Community Education Association as well.
Thank you. Now, I know we just have a few minutes, but I think you have some things you'd like to tell us about community education.
Yes, thank you very much. And we appreciate Senator Olson's invitation to come and address our model. In Minnesota, we're very proud of the community education program, and Senator Olson had asked in particular to address two aspects of our very comprehensive program. One is our flexible model, and the other is our comprehensive approach to student achievement. And I believe you have a handout that we provided to the staff that would be with committee members. So if you'd like to refer to that. We have one statewide delivery system, and yet we touch over 3 million of our citizens in Minnesota. Community education is in 340 school districts across the state, so it is a comprehensive vehicle to reach the entire state of Minnesota. Fiscal efficiency is something that's at our core. For every tax dollar invested in any of our programs that come under the community education umbrella, we generate another $6 in revenue from outside sources, fees and grants, and other opportunities to partner and raise revenue to provide service. Community education is locally controlled by boards of education, and programs meet local needs, so you will see variations across the state, both in our rural, suburban, and urban areas. We use publicly owned school facilities, and we leverage community partnerships, so we're bringing resources into the public education system. And we serve learners of all ages. You've been hearing about early childhood, which is a big part of community education, and we serve almost 300,000 early learners, 1.7 million school-age youth, and over 900,000 adults as well. So a very comprehensive program. In terms of student achievement, we, again, hit all areas of student achievement. For school-age youth, we are coming into the summer months, and people talk about a longer school year or more time in learning. And summer is a critical time, and community education is a very important provider of summer programs across the state. One piece of research I'd love to highlight was done by John Hopkins, Professor Carl Alexander, showing that low-income youth suffer significantly from a loss of academic skills over the summertime. And in their research, two-thirds of ninth-grade academic achievement gap between disadvantaged youngsters and their more advantaged peers was explained by what happened over the summer during their elementary years. So it's critical time that kids need to be engaged in learning, and Community Ed is gearing up for that across the state. A couple of programs that Senator Olson wanted us to especially share is we're not only dealing with our students most academically challenged, we're also preparing our learners for the 21st century. One of her districts, we're doing a summer robotics academy, we're doing environmental learning, we're doing things that really engage learners and are preparing our students to be the competitive workforce of Minnesota. In terms of our students most in need, We have an array of services from tutoring and targeted services and mentorship programs and academic skills programs. In my own district, we have targeted the 10% of our very lowest readers in our elementary school. And those kids are involved in an after-school literacy program 2 days a week because they are the children falling behind and reading is critical. So we have targeted those kids that need it most, and we're extending their school day. So it's an important part of what we're doing with school-age youth. Touching 1.7 million contacts with youth across the state gives us tremendous potential, and our flexible model allows us to do a wide variety of services that can address the achievement gap. I'd like my colleague, Dave, to address a couple of the other areas that are important in how Community Ed addresses the achievement gap.
Thank you, Ms. Luca. Mr. Maurer.
I'll be very quick. In Cambridge-Sandy, we have a preschool program that has 280 students in it. It's integrated with early childhood special education. One of the things that we have is a curriculum that was chosen in conjunction with kindergarten teachers and our director of teaching and learning. We also have a focus of learning, and when I came to Cambridge ISANDE, there was a focus of learning for each grade level that outlined the learning goals for the focus of learning. A few years ago, our early childhood coordinator and the director of teaching and learning created one for all of our early childhood programs. So our early childhood programs align with the flow of education into kindergarten to help children enter kindergarten prepared to learn. Quick example of how we use our scholarship dollars for school readiness. We scholarship students into preschool programs. We have 63 students in Cambridge ISANDE out of the 280-plus that are receiving scholarships. Of those, 44 qualify for a 60% or more scholarship, and 25 of them are currently receiving a 100% scholarship. That's this fiscal year. And then one of the quick comments I would make is about our ABE program. One of the great successes that we've had in our program, and I think it's mirrored around the state, is with the fast-track programs. There, we've done them in conjunction with Pine Tech and Pine College, and they're very specific training to get people back into the workforce. And a couple of those that we've done this year have been very successful, and of the students that graduated, I don't have the exact numbers, but I know 50% or more out of one got jobs as a result of that. So a quick plug for something that ABE is doing very successfully in our district, but I believe it's also mirrored around the state.
Thank you, Mr. Maurer. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Sieben.
Madam Chair, the presenter referenced a handout, and I don't know if, do we have that in our committee packets?
I will see.
It looks like this one. Do you have that one?
That was in my packet. Do you not have it?
No.
I think it's coming around, an additional one. Are there any other comments for the testifiers? Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. DeLuca, is the program that's targeted for those 10% at-risk students, is that optional or mandatory? And what is the percentage, if it's optional, that are participating?
Good question. It is optional. It's provided through a collaboration between Community Ed and our elementary schools. And we sent invitations to all of the children. We're at that lowest percentile. And what I can tell you is in the K-2 ages, we had a 99% say yes. And then in the 3 to 5, slightly less, but still above 75% of the parents took advantage of the program and were very appreciative of the extra support for their students. So we're very excited about that.
Chair. Senator Wieger.
And thank you. Will you be tracking the growth in the...
Yes. We're measuring, students? We're looking at the fall data that we have for those students in their reading scores, and then we're measuring it again every spring and then fall until those students are caught up to their peers in reading at proficient or above levels.
Are there any further questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Wieger.
Madam Chair, Mr. Maurer, what is the percentage of growth for the students? I think you said there were 63 or so. I wasn't quite sure how many, but what has been the growth been for participants in the program?
Mr. Maurer.
Madam Chair, Senator Wieger, they're current students now, so we've pre-tested them. They're not done with the school year yet, so we have not post-tested them. So I don't have an answer for that question. We have students from last year that I could get that data and get to you. We had, I have the data here, but on the amount of students from last year, but I did not bring that with me.
Okay, well, yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Maurer. We are zealously pursuing best practices and what works and what we fund. And if you can show that for what the results were last year, I'd find it helpful.
Thank you, Senator Wieger. Members, just so you know, we have two more brief testifiers speaking on Head Start and Montessori. Thank you very much for your
testimony.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have Gail Kelly, who wanted to speak about Head Start? Thank you, Ms. Kelly. If you could introduce yourself, please, for the committee. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. My name is Gail Kelly. I'm the executive director for the Minnesota Head Start Association, and I live in Duluth, and it was a snowy day to come down, but thank you
for this opportunity. Well, thank you for the long commute.
A Skyline shuttle works well on these days. I'd like to talk about Head Start and Early Head Start, which throughout this I'm just going to refer to as Head Start, just to make it easier. Just a brief overview, there are 35 federally authorized grantees in Minnesota. That includes community action programs, nonprofits, one school district, and tribal governments. Last year, they wrote grants to bring $88.4 million into Minnesota to provide early learning and family development services. The state of Minnesota has been kind enough over the last 23 years, to supplement that and build on that infrastructure to serve an additional $2,500 with $2 million a year. And this last year, we also received an opportunity to add 900 children, primarily early Head Start, with the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. Those funds will sunset on September 28th of this year. So together, there are 15,300 Head Start children in Minnesota. And this is not an entitlement program. We can only serve those we're funded. And with an income eligibility at 100% of poverty, which for a family of four is $22,350, our dollars aren't going as far as we would like. Eligibility, the number of children in poverty in Minnesota jumped 2% in 2009 to 15.7%. And right now, we currently only serve 28% of the income eligible. 28% of the income eligible children living in poverty in Minnesota. So when we hear about 50% ready, I think it's important to know many of those children who are not ready are not getting the services that they need. Head Start has a priority to serve the most at risk. So we have to determine through risk criteria what children we will serve. And that means that every year we serve more kids with disabilities, homeless families, and children with developmental delay. So our profile last year was 52% of our children were racially diverse, 31% families spoke a language other than English in the home, and 13% were on an IEP or an IFSP. I just want to give you a real picture of what that looks like. The last few years, home visitors in Minneapolis have enrolled children that are living in garages. They have children that are living in basements with no utilities that are jimmy-rigging electricity. On the Iron Range last year, we enrolled a family with a dirt floor. Across Minnesota, hundreds of children are being enrolled that have undiagnosed medical problems, including this year, or in the past couple of years, we diagnosed a child with muscular dystrophy, serious eye conditions, and lead poisoning. Thousands of children that we serve have never seen a dentist, and many have severe dental disease and abscessed teeth when we enroll them in the program. And we're authorized to serve their comprehensive needs. So our federal performance standards say that means we must get them school ready, we must help them with their social competency and health, and we must help their families to become economically self-sufficient. This translates into being very individualized with each child and working with the child in the context of families. We do that by offering research-based curricula, continuous child assessment, and ongoing discussions with parents. And I direct you to the handout that I provided you and the second page. You asked about child outcomes. This is a sample of 1,300 four-year-olds that graduated from Head Start last year. This follows them. This assessment tool is a creative curriculum which looks at a stepwise approach. So the graph shows you the children that were at the highest steps, 2 and 3, when they came into the program and when they left in the spring. And all the critical domains, language, emerging literacy, social, emotional, physical health, we either nearly doubled or tripled the number of children that were ready in those domains when they left us. We've shown steady progress in looking at our outcomes, and we have a database of over 4,000 children on the CCNET program and over 2,000 children on work sampling. And we've really seen how much since 2001 our partnerships have helped us improve our educational outcomes. Our partnerships with WordWorks and AmeriCorps Early Reading Corps impacts hundreds of classrooms each year and demonstrates stronger literacy and language development outcomes for our children. We have new approaches which we've been working with our dual language learners and really have seen stronger gains for those children. And our focus on children's emotional health, particularly with the implementation of curricula like Incredible Years, have really given our teachers new skills to work with challenging behaviors and particularly identify those children that need more support from our mental health consultants. Reforms under the 2007 School Readiness Act will continue to translate into higher quality. We have higher professional development requirements. We're using class and observing all our teachers. And there is recompetition for the lowest performing Head Start programs. I think every year kids come to us at Head Start at different stages of development, and we have to get them ready. And national studies and local program data show that Head Start is doing the job. I know there's been a lot of talk in this committee about the Head Start impact study, and so I put a one-page fact sheet in your packets that I hope you'll take a look at. I don't have much time, but the one claim that seems to be forgotten when people talk about this, the authors cited in that study, is Head Start children outperformed the control group on every domain that the study measured when they left Head Start, on every domain that the study measured. Head Start children made significant cognitive, social-emotional gains and were in better health compared to the control group. Head Start children were more ready for school than the peers in the control group. Now, the studies, again, I want to say that these impacts were found when children had Head Start for only 6 to 9 months, and many of the children in the control group were in other preschool programs, including many of them found their way into Head Start. So I think it's important, though, that our people want to talk about what happens when they leave Head Start. First, I want to say very clearly, we can't keep them. We have to let them go. When we have no control over the quality of the schools that they enter, the teachers that they receive, or the quality of instruction. The study did show that upon first grade, the control group caught up with the Head Start children. I don't call it fading. It's the control group caught up to the Head Start children on many cognitive measures. And we like to really work with schools to see if those gains that we made in Head Start can be continued. We think a lot of that could be with partnerships with their parents. And we find the partnerships that we have with our Head Start parents is where those gains really can take hold. Remember, there are many other long-term studies. You've got to look at research in the whole, and there's many other long-term studies that tell us that the cognitive measures do sustain. Head Start children have higher graduation rates than their peers. They're less likely to repeat school, and they're more likely to finish, not need special education. They're also less likely to commit a crime. I really want to say before I end the importance of Head Start as an economic engine in our communities. We are everywhere in the state. Last year, when Parent Aware needed quality places for their scholarships, we were offering 30% of those positions. We have over 3,400 full-time staff, about a job for every 4.5 children. 70-80% of our funds go into salaries and benefits. The remaining funds go directly back into the community, funding food, gas, facilities, and supplies. It's largely local control, and it's the best, and it's designed to fit the needs of the community. So I'd like to say to the committee, we truly hope you'll maintain state enrollment in Head Start. State funds represent 2,500 high-risk children, 500 jobs, and over 120 classrooms across the state. The lost Minnesota families of these resources would have serious consequences on kindergarten readiness. And as James Heckman recommended to the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility, early Head Start and Head Start are programs on which to build and improve, not to cut.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly. Members, because of the time, if you have comments that do not need to be on the record, if you could follow up with Ms. Kelly, we have one more presentation. Is there anyone that feels they need to make a comment on the record or a question on the record? All right, thank you, Ms. Kelly. You may have members who'd like to visit with you when we're finished. Thank you so much. And now if we could have Juanita Fernandez with the Montessori Training Center of Minnesota, please. Thank you, Ms. Fernandez. Please introduce yourself for the tape and welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Senator Olson and members of the committee.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, excuse me, Olson. My name is Juanita Fernandez, and I am the Director of Community Outreach for the Montessori Training Center of Minnesota, which is a nonprofit organization offering graduate level.
And if you could pull the mic up just a tad closer, please.
There?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Joining me is Anne Luce, Head of School of Brightwater Montessori, and Janice LaFleau, Director of Development for the American Indian Family Center. We would like to thank you for the opportunity to present to you today. I'm here to ask the Senate to challenge the paradigm of total reading by third grade. This sets too low of a standard for our children. The problem is that we are starting too late. For over 100 years, the Montessori method has proven that children have an amazing capacity to learn during their first 6 years of childhood. In the setting of a prepared environment, manipulative material, and a well-trained teacher, a child can master total reading comprehension, geography, the decimal system, and fractions by age 6. Montessori is a world-renowned method. There are now a few Montessori schools in the country that have been established for children of every economic background and ethnicity. The East Dallas Community School is a Montessori school where 67% of children are from low-income families. Their ongoing tracking of the students shows that 94% of the children who completed third grade have graduated high school, compared to a community rate of 50%, with 88% of them progressing to college. Here in Minnesota, we have our own AMI Montessori schools that have been established to serve the broad community, starting with Brightwater Montessori School in North Minneapolis and Cornerstone in East St. Paul. At Brightwater Montessori, 87% of four-year-olds were proficient in language literacy skills. Children attending Cornerstone are performing in the average to high average range in the domains of academic achievement and early concept formation. Cornerstone serves presently 70% low-income families. The Hiawatha Foundation has awarded the Montessori Training Center a generous grant to help support the co-development of 10 AMI Montessori schools within diverse communities, providing teacher training scholarships and technical assistance. Leaders of various communities in the Twin Cities have researched and witnessed the impact that the Montessori method has had on children at Cornerstone Montessori, and they have now decided to establish a Montessori school in their own communities under this project. Some of these organizations include the Hmong American Partnership, Centro, an organization serving the Latino community in Minneapolis, Little Earth of United Tribes, and American Indian Family Center. I have invited Janice LaFleau from American Indian Family Center to provide a firsthand account on why they have chosen the Montessori method above other curriculums for their community.
Thank you, Ms. Fernandez. Ms. LaFleau.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for taking a few minutes to listen to our presentation.
Could you introduce yourself, please, and spell your name for the committee?
My name is Janice LaFleau, L-A-F as in family, L-O-E, and I'm the Director of Development at the American Indian Family Center.
Thank you.
We have been at the table with Cornerstone Montessori for a little over a year, exploring the opportunity to begin a new Montessori site for the American Indian community here in St. Paul. The opportunity at the table provides the expertise of bringing in all of the relevant information and the technical assistance for us as a community center, and with Cornerstone Montessori to bring those together and be able to move forward with creating that same opportunity as Brightwater has in North Minneapolis to the east side, and more specifically for the American Indian community. We are extremely pleased by the opportunity because Montessori is one of the few that lays a framework that allows a community like the American Indian community to layer over our own values and practices that merges both concepts together and promotes learning and development at a very high quality level. Montessori certainly has a reputation in the state of Minnesota as being one of the highest quality programs, and the merged effort between the two will mean that the Indian kids in St. Paul will have that opportunity in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. LaFleau. Is there one other testifier that would like to speak today?
I'm just here for questions. I'm Ann Luce from Brightwater Montessori School in North Minneapolis, and I'm delighted to be here. Thank you very much. Are there any questions that need to go on the record for the committee?
Just a brief one.
Senator Wieger.
But initially, the testimony was that the third grade goal we have for reading proficiency should be reconsidered. What grade level would you put it at?
We would put it at first grade.
Ms. LaFleau.
First grade, and you think that's attainable? Absolutely.
We certainly do. We see our children now at Cornerstone reading, actually doing total reading at age six.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wieger. Seeing no further business before the Education Committee, the committee is almost adjourned, but I have one reminder for you. Tomorrow is going to be a busy day as well. We have a lot of testifiers on the agenda. I want to thank you for your flexibility and commitment staying long today. We encourage early attendance tomorrow. Meeting's adjourned.